Welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words. I'm your co-host, Judy Alexander, and I'm here with my husband, Dr. Bruce Chalmer.
Hello, Judy. Hello, viewers and listeners. And our topic for today is?
Helping Women Who Have Experienced Violence, an interview with Reverend Cheryl Kincaid.
We just finished that interview, and really, really informative and inspiring, I think, interview.
Yeah,
Reverend
she's an
Kincaid.
Inspiring person.
She's very inspiring. She is a Presbyterian minister and very committed Christian. And of course, we are not Christian, we are Jewish, and we found there's lots in common. And I mean, there's differences and there's things in common, but I think I really enjoyed our conversation.
A lot of good things to say.
And very, very inspiring. And if you are someone who has experienced violence in particular, I think you'll be of interest. She has a lot to say to women, especially women who've experienced violence. So that we will get to in just a moment. First, a word from our various and sundry things that we are touting here,
okay.
including your call.
Well, why don't we start with your books? It's the latest one. It's not communication. It's not about communication. Why everything you know about couples therapy is wrong.
Indeed.
And I think I have that here. Here we are.
So for those of you watching, Judy is holding up the beautiful book cover. I really like that book
cover.
I
do too.
I don't claim credit for the design. Actually, it's your idea, as I recall.
That was based on my idea, yes.
The artist
but I did
took
not
it and,
execute that. Because I'm not that artistic.
That's
but
right.
They did a great job.
They did a great job. Mm-hmm. And then my previous book, the one that got all this started, three years ago.
Reigniting the Spark, Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back.
And those are both available anywhere books are sold. You can get the audiobook and the ebook versions from Amazon. Mm-hmm. And I also have a couple of booklets I don't think we have to go into a lot of detail about. I do want to mention about one of the booklets that I wrote. Mm-hmm. The one called 7 Words to Jumpstart Your Love Life.
Yeah.
That's a really nice, well, you might as well hold it up since I'm mentioning it. That's a nice booklet. And Judy's holding up the paperback version. It's a nice book. It's got some, I've got, you know, stock photos in there and it's, you know, it's a nice book.
Yeah.
But you don't have to buy it.
No, you don't?
No. Well, I mean, I'd like it if you bought it, but you don't have to buy it because I will give you a PDF of that book, complete with pictures, by the way. And of course, the paperback version only has black and white pictures. The PDF has them in color. How about that?
Mm.
And so I will give that to you for free. All you have to do is go to our website, ctn7.com, and you will see a magic box appear that says, sign up for Dr. Chalmers' newsletter. When you sign up for my newsletter, I will give you, I mean, what you will receive is an email that has a link to that PDF, which you are free to download and enjoy. So that is available to you without charge.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's also put in a word while we're talking about great stuff you can acquire for our merch. Our merch, which we are holding up. Let's do the clink again for people who are just listening. What do you suppose that clink is, folks? Well, by golly, it's us clinking together our beautiful Couples Therapy in 7 Words mugs.
Mm-hmm. In the 11-ounce and 15-ounce sizes, with our beautiful logo on one side and our motto, Be Kind, Don't Panic, and Have Faith, on the other.
Yes, and you need that mug, by golly, and you also need the tote bag that has the same logo and motto on it.
And t-shirts,
and I think that's what we've got by way of merch. And where can you find that merch? Why?
You can go to ctn7, that's the numeral 7.com.
And you will see there is a shop tab, and that will take you to our little online store where you can purchase those items and, you know, give them as gifts. So we hope you enjoy that. And now let's put in a word from our sponsor. And who is our sponsor?
Our sponsor, that would be The Blue Tent, Erotic Tales from the Bible by Laria Zilber.
Yes, indeed. A really, if you like erotica, I highly recommend this book.
Hot, steamy, sexy, spicy, all those words that go along with it.
And also, very respectfully biblical.
Yes.
So if you like Bible and you like sex. And those are not mutually exclusive categories at all.
No, they are not, because there's a lot of sex in that Bible.
There's a lot of sex.
And I guess Laria writes all about it in this wonderful book.
Yes.
Of 10 short stories based on biblical characters that come right from the Bible and from what's called Midrash, which is Jewish interpretive tales from the Bible. So,
indeed.
It's all based on that. So.
And she is very familiar with that. And mm-hmm. So we highly recommend that. And if you want to get that book, you can go to LariaZilber.com. Those of you watching this are seeing it projected over our heads by the magic of video editing as we speak. And Laria is LariaZilber, LariaZilber.com. And you can get it there, and you can get the audiobook, which was narrated by none other than Judy with her beautifully, wonderfully, enjoyably sexy voice.
Thank you.
And you can tell what I fell in love with. And she does a wonderful job narrating it.
And it's also available on Kindle and paperback.
Indeed. And so let us now turn to our interview with Reverend Cheryl Kincaid, and we will see you on the other side.
Our guest today is Reverend Cheryl Kincaid. Reverend Kincaid is a Presbyterian minister who studied marriage and family therapy at Bethel Seminary and has a Master of Divinity from San Francisco Theological Seminary. Before entering seminary, she taught preschool for 20 years and was a foster parent. Reverend Kincaid facilitated support groups for women who had suffered abuse for 7 years. She is now the head of staff at Calvary Presbyterian Church in Enfield, Connecticut. Reverend Kincaid seeks to tell the story of God's comforting redemptive grace amid an imperfect world. She confesses that many of her stories were inspired from witnessing God's redemptive grace unfold in wounded Christian lives, including her own. Reverend Kincaid is the author of 4 published books. Her most recent book is A Forgotten Door Called Home, which is a sequel to her previous book, Carrie's Thorn, a coming-of-age book about a girl in foster care. Cheryl, welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's our pleasure.
We're delighted to have you.
Indeed. Nice.
So we always like to start off by asking folks, you know, how did you get into the work you do? You know, tell us something about your own journey that brought you to where you are.
I think, in short, it sounds like a Sunday school answer, but it's just the truth. It was a call of God on my life. I found Christ out of my abuse, so to speak. I heard a voice say, God is love, when I was equating my abuse to love. And I heard a very strong voice and felt a hand on my stomach and heard a voice say, God is love. And from that moment on, I wanted to communicate the love of God in Jesus Christ. So that's what called me to the pulpit. Like most evangelical women, I had a little bit of a difficult journey finding my way through seminary and understanding what it meant for a woman to preach and teach. But my abuse journey was part of my faith, and so it kind of naturally flowed into the ministry. Because, you know, you think of the passage in Corinthians where Paul says, comfort one another with the comforts where you've been given. And that's essentially what Jesus saved me from, what Jesus is, the work that he's working out in my life. And so the issue of theodicy, which means where is God when there's suffering, has been a major part of my ministry since I first began to minister.
I should mention, and of course, a lot of our viewers will know this, we're not Christians, we're Jewish.
Okay.
I'm very comfortable talking with you know.
Believing. I didn't know that. I'm so sorry. I hope I wasn't.
No, need to apologize. Exactly.
This is your journey, not ours.
Absolutely. But... Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
So I just wanted to mention that just by way of saying, but it's interesting when you talk about the notion of theodicy, because I happen to be at our synagogue. I happen to be involved because I'm a mental health provider. We have a group that the rabbi is putting together of folks who are available basically to help him out when there's too much of a load in terms of pastoral counseling. And one of the books we've read is Harold Kushner's book, Why Bad Things Happen to Good People,
yes.
Which is really centered on that idea of theodicy. He's coming from a Jewish perspective, but it's, you know, there's a lot of commonality, I think.
It's an excellent book. Yeah. Well, we start from the same foundation. So yeah, we have a lot in common and the issue is still the same because we both believe in a sovereign God mm-hmm. who's benevolent toward his people and yet these horrible things happen.
Yeah.
And how exactly. do we, and where is the redemption of the of God's love in the midst of it? Mm-hmm. And that's always a struggle for everyone.
it's kind of the central struggle in a lot of ways, certainly with respect to that issue of how do you maintain faith in a benevolent God when bad things are happening, you know,
yes.
And violence, of course, being one of the chiefest bad things.
Yes, that's true. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's been a struggle to realize that God is not in the fallenness, he's in the healing. So like many people who've gone through abusive situations, I kind of grew up from after the abuse. My father went away to jail. The abuse stopped at a certain age. Mm-hmm. And I was just living a normal life, but I had learning disabilities and I had trauma that I didn't understand. Mm-hmm. And in the Christian world, sometimes you can get caught up in some really bad thinking. And the bad thinking I got caught up was the belief system that somehow my what you would call post-traumatic stress disorder, my nightmares and my flashbacks were demons. And I tried to cast them out. And that's not unusual. Mm-hmm. People will pray them away and try to push them away and try to just think positive thinking. I think that's across all faiths. That's what people do. And I had to embrace it as part of my humanity, that I was human. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I ever forgot what happened. I never thought it wasn't real. I just thought it was something that was weird and I should just forget about it. But it's when I embraced it, when I understood that it's part of humanity, that it happens to a lot of people. And in that humanity, by overcoming it, is when I found strength and power. Mm. And that's the struggle that that I want to communicate to other people.
Now, did your family find any support from the church when this was happening?
So Carrie Thorne, my book here, mm-hmm. I purposely wrote about the church in it because I've been on one side of it. Now I'm on the other side. Mm-hmm. Many people in the church knew something was wrong. And I had many teachers that knew something was wrong. And this is in the 60s and 70s. So it was before Child Protective Services was really that much on everyone's radar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But people did call the police. People were worried, but they didn't know what to do. And so mm-hmm. I make them major characters in both the books of the people in Carrie and Lalone. Carrie is the girl that's going through foster care, and her best friend is Lalone. They meet in a group home in La Jolla. Lalone is from Hawaii, but both of them have these concerned adults, aunts and uncles and people in their churches and people who, and the grandparents that want to do something and they're not quite sure what to do. Mm-hmm. And I think we're so used to, because we watch a lot of television movies on this subject a lot, and there's always bad guys and good guys when mm-hmm. we do movies. And there's someone who just ignores it and someone who goes in and is the savior. But in reality, life is more nuanced than that. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of people that can be deeply concerned, but aren't quite sure what to do. Mm, and they bring their history into it as well. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I wanted to write the book. I wanted to write a book where there wasn't definite bad guys and good guys, where there was people really trying to deal with the abuse.
It's fascinating. You know, as a mandated reporter myself for like the last 30 years, it's been interesting. I haven't run into that many situations, especially because mostly what I do is couples therapy now. But it is an interesting phenomenon when you recognize that indeed you might be required to report something, which of course I would do if I had to. But it wasn't always clear that that was actually benefiting the person you're trying to benefit. You know, it was much more nuanced than that. Sometimes reporting was just what was needed. Sometimes reporting just made things worse or not any better.
And in the foster care system, I tried to paint a fair picture of it, mm-hmm. but because Carrie's foster mom has her own issues mm-hmm. when she takes Carrie in her house,
sure.
and she projects them upon Carrie. So I wanted to write a picture of heroic human beings with all their flaws, mm-hmm. you know, trying to get through this impossible thing when something that should have never been broken was broken.
Mm.
And how do we find empowerment out of it? So in both the books, the characters are struggling with that. Mm-hmm. In A Forgotten Door Called Home, I added a refugee from Guatemala who would be the mother of the woman who owned the restaurant who employed Carrie to talk about generational trauma. And Lalonde's mom, who Lalonde's grandma, Nikki, who was abused in a missionary school. I wanted to look at different forms of trauma. One of the reasons that made me write these particular books was when I facilitated support groups for survivors of abuse. One of the complaints is whenever there were books or movies about survivors of incest, they always painted the pictures of the women as becoming prostitutes or drug addicts or having eating disorders.
Yeah, yeah.
There wasn't an image of an average girl that was a part of church or maybe a synagogue just trying to do her best and living with this at home.
Yeah.
There wasn't an image, and that's what I wanted to paint. I wanted to paint a realistic. I think the horror of abuse is that it takes place in normal settings.
Yes.
Very normal.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. And I find that, you know, one of the markers of a good book, if I may be judgmental, as opposed to one that's just, you know, sort of, you know, therapy literature, is that it's realistic in that very sense. That it's usually not all about good guys and bad guys. It's usually much more nuanced. And absolutely, you know, if you look at the numbers of people who've been abused and sexually abused, physically abused, whatever, compared with the numbers of people who do abuse or the numbers of people who end up, you know, in, as prostitutes or as drug addicts or whatever it might be, there's a lot more people that were abused than have those issues.
That's true.
And it's interesting, that phenomenon, that, yeah, the way things are portrayed, you know, so many of the movies will portray things in such a shallow way, and it doesn't really, you know, it's interesting that you had these experiences yourself, and that undoubtedly helped you write about it much more realistically.
Yeah, and I think that also sets the survivor up for being abused again or belittled in workplace situations or in are when they come out with their story, because then you must have this problem. You must be Glenn Close in Fatal Attraction. You must, you know, it puts stereotypes on them, sexist stereotypes that don't belong there. So yeah, it's really important to notice that most survivors don't go into sex work. David Finkelhorn, you might be familiar with his work, The Dark Side of Families. He's a psychotherapist.
I don't know that one,
but no. He talked about 85% of prostitutes say that they were molested, but that does not mean 85% of molested people become prostitutes.
Exactly. Right.
So let's look at the numbers correctly, please. Many of them go to college, get married, have kids, and struggle with this the rest of their life in the sea of humanity. And that was what I wanted to write about in the book.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I noted it is that you've written about one of the questions you were suggesting, even I was fascinated by, why is it difficult to talk about family violence in Christian circles? And I want to just preface that question noting it often is in Jewish circles as well. Interestingly, differently when you're talking about Orthodox, you sort of more I don't want to use the word fundamentalist all the time, but often more fundamentalist types versus more liberal types. There's characteristic differences in how difficult it is, but it's difficult in both. I'm curious what your experience in Christian circles.
Well, this is where both the Jewish and the Christian circles have something in common. So in Judaism and in Christianity, our faith is atomistic. We don't go through someone to get to God. We get to go directly to God. Mm-hmm. That's the gift of our faith. From Abraham and Moses, there was a relationship. Abraham walked with God. We have that choice to walk with God. Somehow in the 60s and the 70s, and I'm sure it was before then, but what we started to do is we said, instead of being salvaic or God-centered, we started to put the focus on the family. Maybe if we could get the family straight, we could cure all morality. And the family became almost an idol, and we exalted it. And the worst thing you could ever do was break up a family. And so abuse became to be seen as an attack on the family when women came forward. It's also the idea of a patriarchy. And I know that both within Judaism and in Christianity, when we interpret the Old Testament, there's a feminist critique on the scriptures. But God says, I am who he is, and it's a genderless. So, and yet we translate it as him, And there's
Hebrew has no neuter.
That's the default, you know.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
But the reality is that we lift up the male type as the high type, and that women should be subservient to the male type. And I'm not sure that's what the scripture teaches. Mm-hmm. Again and again, I'm just not sure.
Yeah, I think it does. both our traditions, and including Islam, they're all patriarchies. So in that sense, it does have that the maleness is the authority figure, whether it's the king or the father, or God is the king or the father of the family, you do have a patriarchy. So if there is abuse happening, whether it's from a father or a priest or a minister or a rabbi, it's really hard to go against that figure that's been so ingrained in you. It's like, this is like the knowing, the all-knowing person. And how do I report? And that's why there were so many problems over the years in churches and then synagogues. You hear about rabbis who have been, and people are like, I can't believe that he ever would have done that. Mm-hmm. And he was such a wonderful man, and it has split congregations, as I'm sure it has in the Protestant and in the Catholic world, where people just cannot even fathom that, this wonderful man would do such a horrible thing when he was so good to so many people.
That's true. But I want to backtrack just a little bit, because in the creation story, we have two sets of creation stories.
Yeah. But yes,
one is. One is when Eve is created out of Adam's rib. The other is God created man in his image.
Male created he them. Yes.
Yes.
Male and female. So our image. So I want to go back to equity just for a second. Women are created in God's image just as men are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's our direct line. And why we have men in authority, we have people like Deborah rising up. When she needs to take the staff and being an authority in the Old Testament, we have women rise. We have great matriarchs in the Old and New Testament who stand up and proclaim the word of God.
I will mention our synagogue sisterhood. Judy led a sisterhood service, and it happened to be centered on Deborah this time, mm-hmm. this particular time.
I've done some study groups on Deborah and Ruth and other women who have prominent roles in the Bible.
But that gift, my point is that gift gives us a ministry directly to God, mm-hmm. as a person of faith. And I think the reason why it's hard, I you made a really good point when you said that's why it's hard to come against, because there is a patriarchy within our religion, within both of our religions, that makes it hard for women to come forward. But I would argue what I'd like to empower women with is that they have that relationship with God apart from the patriarchy. They have that relationship. They have the right to dignity because they're created in God's image. Mm-hmm. And that dignity surpasses the family.
Mm. And it's interesting because you're bringing out that exists in our sacred texts. It's there. Indeed, patriarchy has been the dominant sociological force. But that the phenomenon that women can learn, and here I am mansplaining to a couple of women here, right? But that phenomenon that women can learn, the sense that no, dignity is also embedded in these religions. Because the alternative, and there's numbers of people, especially numbers of women, who've concluded this, the alternative is to say that these religions are just hopelessly patriarchal and corrupt, and there's no place for women in them. Much like, gay people will say, well, there's no place for gay people in Judaism or Christianity or Islam or whatever. And then we have a gay rabbi in our synagogue. It's like, well, apparently there are ways of being gay and still being a committed Jew. I think that's true of being a committed Christian as well, as certainly being a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And also, and here you are an example, a woman who is also a committed Christian is obviously possible in spite of the patriarchy.
And it's possible to have healing. And from a Christian perspective, we always say that's why Jesus spent so much time. I've told women that, mm-hmm. with fallen women, with women. I think that's, I told, when I facilitated support groups, it was a while I worked in a mission, and I was talking to a woman who was coming out of sex work. And I said, I think that's why Jesus spent so much time with prostitutes. He mm-hmm. knows about the pain.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality in the Old and New Testament, the fact that women are even mentioned and that women have a prominent role, when you look at other ancient literature, it really exalts women, I think, to a greater position than when we look at other literature. Mm-hmm. So I think, but my point is, we do have dignity in Christ, and you have dignity in the Jewish tradition that you're created in God's image. Mm-hmm. Male and female. You just said it in Hebrew, which was wonderful. Male and female, he made them. Mm-hmm. And that's what I try to empower women with, is that you have the right to get out of a bad situation. You weren't created for abuse. We just talked about the two creation stories. Humanity was created to know and to serve God and to manage creation. And part of managing creation is not allowing it to be abused. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's the lessons of Genesis 1 and 2, is not to let creation be abused and misused.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I am also curious, you pointed out something which I really found fascinating. The idea of forgiveness is often used against women, and you were describing it, I'm imagining it within a church context. And it's another thing I've heard, maybe not as much in Jewish context, although maybe in Orthodox context that can happen. But I'm curious if you could comment on that. Like, how does
concept of forgiveness? I want to make a definition for anyone who's listening between forgiveness and denial, and what does it mean? Mm-hmm. Yep. So in the Christian concept, the big, and I'm sure you've heard this before, but the lesson of Christianity is that we're obligated to forgive because Christ forgave us. And that's... Mm-hmm. That's why we step into this role called a Christian. And women can get beaten up with that a lot. What I use, and I think in all religious centers, in all religious groups, because I was sitting next to a woman at an art show the other day. I was selling my book and she was selling arts, and she was Muslim. Mm-hmm. And she was saying that she has the same thing in her tradition, that women should put up with things. Mm-hmm. And that's not the same as forgiveness.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So so I think amongst all people of faith, this might be true. But in order to forgive someone, you first must admit that they've done something wrong to you, that they violated you. Mm-hmm. That's a confession. When you admit that, then you, the response to that is caution. Mm-hmm. Because this person is capable of hurting you again.
I've often commented on that to folks in talking about forgiveness, that forgiveness, at least in the sense you're describing, does not make you stupid. You know, it's like, and unfortunately, the forgiveness as described sometimes by people who would say, oh, you're required to forgive, you know, it's, you know, where I see it even more than in forgiving a parent is forgiving a spouse. You know, if your husband is beating you up, and people will be told, well, you have to forgive him and, you know, do your best to be a good wife and stuff like that. And that's basically saying, okay, so you shouldn't be cautious about being abused by someone. In the spirit of forgiveness, you can forgive someone that you're not safe with. It doesn't make you stupid. It just means you'll be really careful. I one of my go-to stories is a woman I worked with many years ago who forgave an ex-husband who had horribly, horribly abused her. And had done jail time and she maintained a restraining order on him, but she still forgave him. She would never go near him. And if he came near, she would call the cops or do whatever she needed to do. But she did forgive him in the sense of letting go of the anger. She just figured, well, he had these issues and he was really dangerous, but she could at least not carry around the anger with her.
So yeah, I in one of my books, we had one of the girls have a discussion with the pastor on this, and I distinguished that. Forgiveness is relinquishing the anger or the judgment to God. You can't fix this person. Mm-hmm. It's not forgiving and forgetting. And then I say, but denial says the abuse wasn't that bad, or maybe deserved, or maybe you had a role in it. And it leaves the door open for further abuse by silencing the voice of caution. Mm-hmm. So forgiveness should always have caution with it. And that's one thing that God does say in his covenants, is that there's a suzerainty covenant between him and his people. But if his people don't obey him, he withdraws his protection at different times in the Old Testament. And in the same way, we're in a covenant with this other person, the marriage covenant. Ephesians chapter 5 is the passage women get beaten up with. It's about wives and husband. But it's a covenant. As the husband loves you, so you follow him. If he's not loving you, you're not obligated to follow him.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, that's
you can withdraw yourself from that covenant.
Yeah, that is that's pretty central in helping people heal. It's I also want to ask you about something that was just fascinating in the material we looked at, because you've written about Charles. I don't know if this is too big a segue here, but you can tell me. You've written about Charles Dickens and what inspired him to write A Christmas Carol. And I just thought that was a fascinating thing to ask you about. So please tell
me. So anyway, Charles Dickens was always very helpful for me as a kid. I read his books. And I read a preface of his book that his father was in jail, and because my dad was in jail, I empathized with him. But every Christmas Eve, I used to watch A Christmas Carol, and I could sense there was something religious about it, but I couldn't put my finger on it. And when I was in seminary, I did a study on his diary, his letters between him and Foster. And Charles Dickens wrote this book when a couple of things were going on. It was called a Christmas Greeting, but it was the couple of things that were going on was the corn law rules where you taxed corn, the Sabbath rules. And the Sabbath rules was that no one could work on Sabbath, but that made it so servants could not go out and shop on the Sabbath. So the rich people got the time off, but servants didn't have any place to shop. And the most important one was the poorhouse laws. And those were the laws that was trying to get to stop throwing people into debtors' prisons. And the word Ebenezer is a word that means the Lord has brought me thus far. Raise your Ebenezer. And I'm sure you know that Abraham rose an Ebenezer when he was in the wilderness, a rock, to say, God has brought me thus far. So I hypothesize, and I think, I don't know, I'm talking to a couple Dickens scholars, some agree with me, some don't, that each spirit goes along with each lesson of Advent. Because what Dickens wanted to do is he was rebuking the church. It was a clergy person who said in the church, are there no prisons? Are there no workhouses?
Oh, well.
Yeah. And Dickens wrote that down in the Recorder. It was a magazine he worked for. And he was mad at the Anglican church because originally the poorhouses were set up as a compassion instrument. What had happened is that there were people who would labor in the fields in the fall, and they wouldn't have a place to stay during the winter. So initially, this is good intentions going horribly awry. They were set up to house the people. Then eventually they came to be known 50, 75 years into them as punishing the poor. And that's when Dickens comes along. And when his father went into the poorhouse, he was forced to work in a bottling factory. And he got to know what it was like to be in a child in a factory working as a child. And he saw children starve while he was there. And he also lived in the debtor's prison. Mm-hmm. So that one line in the book, are there no prisons? Are there no workhouses? In the Anglican Advent lesson, it starts out with the question. Most of the passages are from Isaiah, which shocked me. That almost all of them are from the Old Testament. But it has to do with not taking care of the poor. Mm. And it was written that way because people turned Jesus away in Bethlehem. And so in the Anglican prayer book, they were preaching, you got to take care of the poor or you'll visit God's wrath upon you. But they were living the opposite way. They were shoving them away in poor houses and in orphanages where they were dying. Mm-hmm. And actually, Dickens would not see the poorhouse laws end, but the Salvation Army would take the character of Tiny Tim and they would use him. They would use him to fight against child labor laws successfully. So Tiny Tim's injured in the book, and everyone always imagines him to have a paralyzed leg. Well, if he had a paralyzed leg, he wouldn't be dying. The book says he's dying. Mm-hmm. At the time in doing Dickens' Day, there was something called the Spinning Jenny. And they put young boys and young girls with a spinning jenny. It was a weaving instrument. And it and the children would have to put thread in between the looms really fast as the looms came down. And children lost their legs and arms in there.
Oh, my.
And my hypothesis is that they were taught Tiny Tim was injured in a workhouse incident. Mm-hmm. And so instead of imagining him as this angelic faced little boy saying, God bless us, everyone, imagine him as a sickly little boy who's got an open wound. And one of the things that Dickens fought for in his life, that and it comes up in Oliver Twist as well, is sewage. There was a lot of open sewage, and the poor didn't have clean water to wash out their wounds.
And so he was Oliver dying of infection, probably, is what.
And Oliver Twist is called the Merk and the Mire, which is it's open sewage. Right. So, so Tiny Tim's death is a lot more profound when you think it's that he's dying of a workhouse injury, and his father happens to work for a banker who supports those workhouses. So it's a sermon, and the word carols used to be ways that peasants would go and sing to rich people at Christmas and get food back. But they're just like the Black spirituals in the United States. Their carols had a little bite to them. They kept talking about how you rejected the Christ child because of your greed. They were kind of putting it to the man in the carols. Mm-hmm. And just like in some of the spirituals, they talk about, I have a master and it ain't you. Mm-hmm. It was the same thing. And people would listen to them like, oh, isn't that wonderful? And it was like saying something completely different than what they thought they were saying. But the reality is he calls it a Christmas carol. It's riddled with all these social issues he's talking about. Mm-hmm. And in the midst of it, there's this sense of redemption. There's this sense that he can find redemption if he finds repentance and lives up to his name, that God could bring him thus far. And so that's hearing the gospel through Charles Dickens, A Christmas Carol.
Wow. That's an interesting spin on it.
Yeah, I love Dickens.
It's an Advent devotion, so it's written with the Anglican prayer books and quotes from Charles Dickens, but I'm hoping to give a lot of facts. I try to give a lot of facts about how the poor were treated, so people will draw correlations to what sometimes we do today.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, you find that throughout all his books. There's always an element of somebody who's, you know, you see it in David Copperfield, and like you said, in Oliver Twist, the whole story centers around that, so very
interesting. And we can, you know, I was thinking of all the scriptures, both in the Old and New Testament, about foreigners and being kind to the foreigner in your land. And and as a nation that claims to be very religious and Christian and Jewish, we're not being very kind to the foreigners in our land.
No,
we're not
obeying those scriptures that we know to be true.
Mm-hmm.
So hearing the gospel was just a way to kind of respond to that. I think in my lifetime, I've seen a political change. I think when I was a little girl, before Reagan, and you could be a Democrat or a Republican and go to church and everything was fine.
Mm-hmm.
And there was compassion for the poor, empathy for the poor. And somehow something changed in our society. We got meaner, we got more partisan.
Yeah.
And I contemplated a lot, but I wanted to write a book that said, listen, guys, the scripture still, Christ stands with the poor and the God of the Old Testament stands with the oppressed.
Mm-hmm.
We can't live a life of hypocrisy and side with the money all the time. We got to stop doing that.
Yeah. Well, so what else should we be asking you about?
Can ask me how to get the books, I guess.
That was going to be my next question. Yes. How can they get the books? How can they find out what you're doing?
If you're listening to me and you've been abused, let me share one word of comfort is that find someone to talk to about it.
Mm-hmm.
You might not have the courage to call the police yet. And I understand that your options may be limited, especially if you're financially dependent upon the abuser. But find someone to talk about it whom you trust to make plans to get out. If you've been abused as a kid, I want you to understand that it's a human thing. And lots of us have gone through it and lots of us come out on the other side strong and powerful, but it's not dynamic and it's not because there's something flawed in you. So I wanted to make that statement. Mm-hmm. So my website is revcherylkincaid.com.
Mm-hmm.
And it's R-E-V, then just my name, C-H-E-R-Y-L-K-I-N-C-A-I-D.
And I'll put that in the notes for the episode as well.
Very good. Yeah. And this is the first book, Carrie's Thorn. And the second book is A Forgotten Door Called Home. And I think if you don't have to be someone who's been abused, but just if you're someone who lives in this society and you're going to be dealing with someone who has some pain because of foster care, mm-hmm. From well-intentioned adults who tried to minister to them.
Yeah.
Just these are good books to read to know the other perspective and to struggle yourself if you're a person of faith of why does a good God allow suffering?
Well, thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
So I hope you enjoyed that interview with Reverend Cheryl Kincaid. And like we said earlier, I found her to be very inspiring. We hope you did too.
Indeed. And we just want to put in a couple of brief words for our various things that you can acquire through our website, ctn7.com. You can get my books, It's Not About Communication, Why Everything You Know About Couples Therapy Is Wrong, and
Reigniting the Spark,
Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back. That one.
It's like too fast for me. 7 Words to Jumpstart Your Love Life, and My Husband Complains About My Cleaning. What do I do? Hint, it's not about the cleaning.
Absolutely. All of those things are available on the website.
Plus our merch, our mugs, the t-shirts, the tote bags.
Right. And by the way, if you've listened this far, folks, please like us and rate us and do all those things that people do. We forgot to mention that in the intro.
That's right. Share us, follow us.
Let people know about us. And now one more word from our sponsor, which is?
The Blue Tent. Erotic Tales from the Bible by Laria Zilber.
Yes, and that's available at lariazilber.com, LariaZylber. If you search for Laria Zilber, you will find her her page. You will find her Amazon page also that lists you can acquire the book.
Right. And I just wanted to put in a word. If you have any topic that you would like us to discuss on air, or if you have a question you would like us to address on air, you can go to ctn7.com and you can let us know, or you can even sign up for a time to be interviewed if you yourself would like to be a guest on our show.
Absolutely. And so until next time,
remember, be kind,
don't panic,
and have faith.